For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Natalie Powell. British MPs have overwhelmingly passed a motion authorising an early general election to be held on June the 8th. The Prime Minister won a majority for a snap election by a vote margin of 522-13 after winning support for the poll from major opposition parties. From London, Catherine Drew reports.
Just one day after Theresa May's bombshell announcement that she was seeking a snap general election, the British leader went to the Parliament to ask MPs to pass a motion to pave the way for the vote.
There are three things that a country needs: a strong economy, strong defence and strong, stable leadership. That's what our plans for Brexit and our plans for a stronger Britain will deliver.
Whilst the election will delay crucial Brexit talks with the European Union as the two-year deadline counts down, analysts say it will buy the British leader crucial time later on by pushing the next election to 2022.
China's foreign ministry spokesperson has said the country is seriously concerned about North Korea's nuclear ambitions, though it doesn't want to raise further tensions. It comes after a failed nuclear missile test from Pyongyang at the weekend, and North Korea saying it will continue to launch nuclear tests despite international condemnation. Law enforcement in California say a man nicknamed Black Jesus killed three white men before being apprehended by police. U.S. correspondent Will Denslow reports.
Speaking to reporters, Police Chief Jerry Dyer said Muhammad fired a minimum of 16 rounds from a handgun in under a minute before giving himself up. After reviewing his statements and Facebook posts, Dyer added that Muhammad, who uses the nickname Black Jesus, doesn't like white people. All the victims were white, and police say that this shooting spree is seen as a random act of violence, with no evidence so far linking it to terrorism. Dyer says Muhammad is a key suspect in last week's killing of a security officer and has a criminal record that includes drugs and weapons charges.
Former NFL star Aaron Hernandez has committed suicide in prison. His death was reported on the same day his former New England Patriot teammates visit the White House. Our US correspondent Kevin McAleese reports.
Hernandez, who was serving a life sentence for a murder conviction, was found by guards in the early hours in a Massachusetts correctional centre. Prison authorities say the 27-year-old hanged himself using a bedsheet that he'd attached to his cell window. Last week, he was acquitted of fatally shooting two men outside a Boston nightclub in 2012. Before his spectacular fall from grace, Hernandez was given a contract by the Patriots worth up to $40 million. His death comes as his former teammates visit the White House to mark their Super Bowl victory earlier this year.
From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Natalie, and a warm welcome to the programme to you. How are you? It's Wednesday, April 19th, 2017. Balmy. Well, it isn't balmy, it's quite chilly actually. Evening here in Manchester. My name is Richie Allen, broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, Alternate Current Radio, TuneIn Radio and more. This is your Richie Allen show. Hope you're well, let's get on with it then.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen show on davidicke.com. The Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Yeah, two fascinating and very different guests today. We'll be joined this hour by the UKIP candidate. Well, he was a UKIP candidate in recent local elections. He's the branch vice chairman in Barnet. Khalid Khan joins me. Very interesting guy, Khalid. We'll be talking about the snap general election, UKIP's commitment to a total Brexit, Syria, Russia, George Osborne, and much more. You're going to be fascinated by Khalid Khan. And in the second hour, boy, am I glad that Catherine Hannaford reached out to me. Catherine is an educational psychologist. She's got degrees in environmental science and a master's in psychology. She's taught at primary and secondary schools, and she's worked in local government. She's got a lot of credentials. She's saying things about the psychological effect of school on children, microwaves, children's mental health, the medication of children, and much more. She is saying brave things. I think she's terrific. Catherine Hannaford joins me in the second hour. You don't want to miss this edition of your Richie Allen Show. And as always, email richie@richieallen.co.uk, but it's best to tweet me. My Twitter handle, as always, is @RichieAllenShow. @RichieAllenShow on Twitter. Get in touch and tell me what you're thinking. A warm welcome to the programme, to you. Right, let's crack on. David is still in Gothenburg, by the way, where he'll be speaking as part of the Worldwide Wake Up Tour on Saturday. Go to theworldwidewakeuptour.com. Excuse me, go to theworldwidewakeup.com for details of future events, venues and ticketing information. As you heard on the news, or the nuacht, as we say in my country, the election was rubber stamped by MPs today, 500 and something to 11 or 12 or something like that. June the 8th, the media loves it. We'll get non-stop coverage now. And you know, we will. Some of you noting today and getting in touch with me saying that the exit or the Brexit negotiations due to take place between the government and the European Union even, will be delayed because of the election in June. Many of our listeners think that's significant. It might be. Like I said yesterday, all opinions have merit. All opinions as to what's really going on have merit. Never forget that we have so many names for them. Hidden Hand, Cabal, Elites. They want unions, political and economic unions, like the European Union, to endure because it's easier to control the many when you concentrate and centralise power. So May's bosses and Farron's bosses and Corbyn's bosses, they all want the same thing. Speculated yesterday as to what's going on. We'll leave it now, just for now, because we'll talk about it with Khalid Khan in a few minutes' time, the European Union and Brexit and all of that. So before that then, Bill O'Reilly I'm going to talk about just for a few minutes. Bill O'Reilly, whatever Irish roots O'Reilly claims to have, we've burned them a long time ago. Who's Bill O'Reilly? If you don't know, I'm sure you do, but some of our listeners might not. He's been a Fox News prime time, what would you call him, commentator, presenter, stalwart for years and years. And I suppose O'Reilly is a poster child for everything that the media became, everything it is today, the corporate propaganda machine that we witness on a daily basis. And I was thinking about it today, and I was thinking, O'Reilly, as much as anybody, maybe more than anybody, made vitriolic commentary, hyperbole, the norm, basically. He made it normal. He was one of the big players in this type of programme and presentation that we see now. Now, you might know, if you know anything about him, that he's had a few problems of late. A New York Times report came out some time ago that revealed that his employers, Fox, spent $13 million settling multiple accusations of sexual harassment against O'Reilly. Multiple. Now, because of that, advertisers boycotted O'Reilly. They ran for the hills. Now, he's dominated the ratings, I suppose, of cable, corporate, 24-hour news. He's been the big man for a long time. And I'm sure the news today is that he's been dropped by Fox. He's been fired, effectively, let go. He's released from his contract. That's what they're saying. But despite that, I'm sure he'll find a home. Somebody mentioned today, bad smells never really go away. The really bad smells. O'Reilly will go somewhere else. And I'll always remember his interview in inverted commas. Yeah, you wouldn't call it an interview. With a young, well, he's not so young now, but he was young then, a young man called Jeremy Glick. You might remember this. Jeremy Glick, his father was killed on September 11th, 2001. He was a port authority worker was Jeremy Glick's dad. And Jeremy put his name to an ad in the newspaper, in a newspaper in New York City, criticising the US government's foreign policies. Now, Glick was lovely, and he was a decent bloke. And this was really my introduction to O'Reilly. This is what happened when he encountered O'Reilly all those years ago.
Our current president now inherited a legacy from his father and inherited a political legacy that's responsible for training militarily, economically, and situating geopolitically the parties involved in the alleged assassination and murder of my father and countless of thousands of others. So I don't see why it's surprising for you to think that I would come back and want to support
it. It is surprising, and I'll tell you why it's surprising. You are mouthing a far-left position that is a marginal position in the society, which you're entitled to. You're entitled to it, all right? But I'm sure your beliefs are sincere, but what upsets me is I don't think your father would be approving of this.
Well, actually, my father thought Ed Bush's presidency was illegitimate.
Maybe he did, but I don't think he'd be equating this country as a terrorist nation.
Well, I wasn't saying that it was necessarily that.
What I'm saying is that
6 months before the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan, starting in the Carter administration and continuing escalating as Bush's father was head of the CIA, we recruited 100,000 radical mujahideen to combat a democratic government in Afghanistan, the Taraki government.
Yeah, really good stuff from the kid. Now, some of you will have heard this. A lot of you won't have heard it. Good stuff from the kid. He said if the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden, if they did it, our government is responsible at least for training these people, the Mujahideen. He went on to say, didn't he, that Bush is illegitimate. He won because of all those African-Americans who were wrongly prevented from voting in Florida. See Catherine Harris. See Jeb Bush. Can't have that. Can't have any sense being talked on national television. So it kicked off, and this, I suppose, has become the norm on television news and radio news programs ever since.
I don't want to debate world politics.
Well, why not? Because, number one,
I don't really care what you think.
Well, okay.
The reason why you care
is because you evoke 9/11 to rationalize. Let me finish. You evoke 9/11 to rationalize everything from domestic plunder to imperialist aggression worldwide. You evoke sympathy
that's
with the 9/11 family.
That's a bunch of crap. I've done more for the 9/11 families by their own admission. I've done more for them than you will ever hope to do.
Okay.
So you keep your mouth shut.
Well, you're not me
exploiting those people.
I'd never represent you.
You know why?
Why?
Because you have a warped view of this world and a warped view of this country.
Well, explain that. Let me give you an example.
No, I'm not going to debate this with you.
Well, let me give you an example of parallel experience.
No,
September 14th.
Here's
don't let him talk. Whatever you do, Bill.
You didn't support the action against Afghanistan to remove the Taliban. You were against it.
Why would I want to brutalize and further punish the people in Afghanistan?
Who killed your father?
The people
who
in Afghanistan
didn't
kill my father.
Sure they did. The Al-Qaeda people were trained there.
The Al-Qaeda people? What about Afghanistan?
See, I'm more angry about it than you are.
So what about George Bush?
What about George Bush? He had nothing to do with it.
The director, senior, as director.
He had nothing to do with it.
The people that trained 100,000 Mujahideen who were...
I hope your mom isn't watching this.
I hope your mother is not watching this.
Because you... That's it. I'm not going to say anymore.
Okay.
In respect for your father...
September 14th, I know what I was doing.
Shut up. In respect for your father, who was a port authority worker.
And then it ends, and O'Reilly basically threatens him off mic when the cameras have gone to news. O'Reilly threatens him to leave the building or he'll knock him out. Now, it's a hugely important piece of audio, that. I don't think I've ever played it on this programme. It demonstrates, I think, perfectly what became of the media, how 24-hour rolling news stopped actually sourcing news, stopped investigating anything and became the mouthpiece of the political and the banking establishment. And I spoke about this when I used to work in training and lecturing would-be radio program producers. I used to use this audio. When somebody like Jeremy Glick was noticed doing anything, saying something that was harmful or potentially harmful to the system, they were brought on programs like that to be ridiculed and shouted at by the likes of O'Reilly, and audiences tended to lap it up. We have it here. We have it now on the national airwaves in this country. And I don't have to tell you the damage that does to education, to real debate, and to informing people of what's really going on, because you're not stupid. The most popular talk radio station in this country is the now national station LBC. Used to be London's biggest conversation, now it's leading Britain's conversation. It's a variety, it's basically a festival of clowns, like Nick Ferrari and James O'Brien. We're going to hear from James O'Brien now. Here's O'Brien treating a caller like dirt and effectively lying about the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. This is important. Listen to this. This is LBC, National Talk Radio in the UK. This is a Mickey Mouse presenter called James O'Brien. This is how he deals with a caller who says he's fed up of political correctness. He's fed up of lies being told about people like Ken Livingstone. Listen carefully.
This is a prime example of political correctness gone mad. Before going on, I'd like to mention that I dislike Ken Livingstone. I don't like much for what he stands for. I have sympathies for the Jews in their struggle against the Palestinians, but I think that this is all nonsense, especially when you read the sentence that Ken Livingstone apparently said. You know, and it's worth going through it again, saying, let's remember when Hitler won his election in 1932.
We've read it out twice already today, but you can read it again if you want. It just means you're going to run out of time to say anything constructive.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the press likes to vilify people. They like to vilify people like Ken Livingstone, Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, people that just speak in a direct manner.
I think you'll find...
But what I resent is that Ken Livingstone has not been proved wrong. There's no proof that Hitler didn't support Zionism in some shape
Good
or form.
Good man.
Okay, so when in 1922 he said that he wanted all the Jews in Germany to be publicly hanged, you think he was sane when he said that?
I think, like someone else said, I think Hitler just wanted the Jews out of the country, whether they're hanged, killed, exterminated, gassed.
Yes, but Livingstone's contention, Richard, I can appreciate that you might think you've won an argument if you never let anybody else speak. But if in 1922 he said that he wanted to publicly hang Jews, and Ken Livingstone's contention is no, he's off.
Look at the definition of Zionism.
I have.
Yes, and that means
it doesn't involve publicly hanging Jews.
No, it doesn't.
Which is what Hitler wanted to do in 1922. Ken Livingstone's contention is that he didn't go mad until some point subsequent to 1932. Can you count?
I'm not arguing again.
Do you hear the massive lie told by O'Brien there, saying that Livingstone maintained or contended that Hitler didn't become mad till 1932? That's actually libelous, that. Because Livingstone said nothing of the sort. And whether Hitler said or didn't say that every Jew in Germany should be hanged in 1922 isn't relevant to whether or not Hitler was doing a deal with Zionists to get Jews and their property to Palestine, you see. This is the health of the state of the media. Moronic muppets like James O'Brien treating people like dirt, and it doesn't get any better, listen. Yeah.
I'm not arguing against that. What I'm arguing...
Yes, you are. You seem to lack the wit to realise what you're arguing against.
He lacks the wit, eh?
You're arguing against that. Ken Livingstone's contention is that Hitler didn't go mad until some point post-1932.
Livingstone never said that.
In 1922, he's on the record as wanting to hang publicly every Jew in Germany. Now, explain to me how that isn't evidence of his Holocaust-supporting madness.
Hitler went mad when he killed...
Definitely, I give up. I really do. I honestly... Well, we can talk about Jeremy Corbyn next. That must be a glutton.
If I ever treat a caller like that on this programme, feel free to delete the programme from every device that you might listen to it on. Right, it's 19 minutes past the hour. That is your mainstream media today. Thought you might find it interesting. Fox News leaving go Bill O'Reilly. But James O'Brien, Ferrari, Katie Hopkins and all the others, the bastard sons and daughters of Bill O'Reilly, infest and inhabit the airwaves of our national media today in 2017. That's his legacy. Very quick break. When we come back, plenty more to tell you. Khalid Khan joins us, and can't wait for you to meet our guest in the second hour. Extraordinary woman, Catherine Hannaford, joins us as well. Back in a minute after these.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Virtually every transaction that involves a child is valuable to somebody.
We intend to show everyone the real reason children are being removed at an alarming rate.
No, this is awful.
The baby's not been seen by the doctor or nothing.
They are psychopathic.
They have got the legal right to kill children now, because that's what they do.
Traffic 2, available now at premiumonpictures.co.uk.
Richie Allen.
Right, you're very welcome back to the programme. It's exactly 21 and a half minutes past the hour. It's Wednesday, April 19th, 2017. A lot of comments there on O'Brien and O'Reilly. To follow what others are saying, do go to twitter.com. In search Twitter, put Richie Allen Show, all one word, press enter, and you'll see what everybody else is tweeting to me, and then you can have a good conversation amongst yourselves, as long as you're polite. We don't mind what you say, as long as you're polite. Alrighty then. Great stuff. The Richie Allen Show on davidike.com, Fab Radio 2, Alternate Current Radio, and TuneIn Radio. This is music from The Who. And when we come back, Khalid Khan from UKIP will be on the line. Minutes past the hour, The Who and The Seeker on The Richie Allen Show. Welcome back. Last night, Norman Baker, former Home Office Minister, Liberal Democrat, was on the programme to talk about the calling of a snap general election by Theresa May, which was rubber stamped today at Westminster by a massive, completely unsurprising, of course, massive majority. There will be a general election on the 8th of June. I thought it was about time we got some UKIP comment. And I like our next guest. I like a lot of what he tweets about global issues, geopolitics. So I've invited him on. He's a former UKIP local election candidate and the branch vice chairman for UKIP at Barnet, I think. I'm delighted to welcome to the programme Khalid Khan. Khalid, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hello, Richard. Doing fine.
Thanks for coming on. And I did ask you this today, but I'll ask you again because our listeners won't be aware of it. It's a bit early. You're not sure whether or not you'll be running in the forthcoming election. You've got hustings and things like that to organise. Is that right, Khalid?
That's correct. Basically, the local party will have a meeting and then we'll have a hustings where we'll invite candidates to put their names forward and then basically go through a process of narrowing them down to the best three, really. And then the three will stand in our three local constituencies.
Right. Well, good luck with that. Straight off, we will talk about why you think the election was called. We'll talk about the other parties. But straight up, is it UKIP's policy? Does it remain UKIP's policy that the leaving of the European Union must be total, that it must include leaving the, not just leaving the political union, but totally leaving the economic union, leaving the single market and the customs union? Is that still the party's position, Khalid?
Absolutely. I mean, UKIP is the only party in the United Kingdom that has campaigned throughout for Britain to regain its independence, as we like to call it. All the other parties, the Lib Dems, the Conservatives, the Labour, the SNP, the Greens even, all of them want even further integration into Europe and the loss of sovereignty. So UKIP has been very staunch and very robust against this. Now, the thing is, a lot of people are talking about what's the difference between a hard Brexit, soft Brexit, all these other terms that they're throwing in. Well, UKIP wants basically independence for the country, you know, control of our borders, control of making laws, control of raising taxes. A lot of people don't realize that the European Union actually takes a cut from our VAT collections. So by regaining our independence, straight away, we'll be able to cut our VAT. By not having to pay the European Union like 12 billion a year, we'll be able to cut our taxes and invest more in our own public services, such as the NHS, for example.
Good stuff. So unequivocally, UKIP's position hasn't changed, out of the customs union, out of the single market. Now, this is really important. I had this back and forth with Norman Baker last night. Norman contended that people didn't know what they were voting for back in June last year. Now, I don't agree with that. It's the reason I invited him on. Now, I know, Khalid, that you took part in, I'm sure you knocked on a million doors last summer, I'm sure you did, last spring even, to talk about these issues. In your opinion, were the people you met on doorsteps, were they aware that, first of all, leaving the European Union meant leaving the single market? That's part one of the question. And part two, was immigration the main or one of the main reasons why those people you met wanted the UK to leave the European Union? First part, were people aware that leaving meant leaving totally?
Yeah, I believe that was made very clear. I mean, you know, there was lots of debates on TV. There was lots of articles in the newspapers. There was lots of discussions, you know, right across the board. I mean, there was discussions on the bus. There was discussions in tube trains, in pubs and clubs and even in supermarkets, as well as on the doorstep. And people were very, very clear that this was a choice between either becoming closely integrated with the rest of Europe, becoming like a new kind of like USSR of Europe or a new United States of Europe. And the alternative was for Britain to become an independent country, you know, such as other countries in the world, like Australia, like Japan, like the United States of America, etc. And having then control over our laws, control over our borders, control over our immigration policy, control of our tax collection, and, you know, just being a normal country like the rest of the world. And then you know, basically then being free to trade with the rest of the world as a, you know, free trade country, you know, not having to be bound by laws that are made in Europe, in Brussels or in Germany or wherever, which we don't have any control over.
Not having to get the permission of 27 other members before you do anything.
Absolutely. I mean, European Union was described by Mikhail Gorbachev as the new Soviet Union. And he, you know, said he couldn't understand why the people of Europe or the countries of Europe had decided to embark on a project which had already failed.
A fascist dictatorship, Nigel Farage once said to me on radio when I interviewed him years ago.
It's a totally undemocratic system. I mean, there's no accountability. There's no public scrutiny. You know, laws are made and, you know, the laws are called directives and EU directives and EU regulations and stuff. And nobody has a say on them. Nobody has any voice. Nobody can object to them. Nobody can complain about them. Nobody can change them.
Immigration, then. There's no doubt from, I mean, I watched it obviously very closely. We talked about it practically every night for 6 weeks leading up to the referendum. And immigration and the lack of control of immigration and the impact of immigration on vital public services was on a lot of people's minds, Khalid. And a lot of people were, and I think I can say this, I know the mainstream media talks nonsense and they don't, you know, they don't have any sources to back up their claims. But I think I can honestly say a lot of people were nervous about talking about immigration, lest they be accused of a little Englander or racist. But people were really concerned about this. Now, I believe what we're seeing at the moment with this nonsense from the Lib Dems and Labour and the SNPs and others about the single market, I think what that's designed to do really is to completely reject the mandate given to the government by the people, which I believe was on immigration almost singularly. And what they want to do by, you know, trying to do some deal to stay in the single market is ultimately to keep that open door immigration system in place, which is exactly what people said they didn't want. Am I right to think that? Am I wrong? How do you see this?
Well, I think one of the things is we've got to look at this from a historic perspective. Yeah, the United Kingdom, Britain, Great Britain has always had immigration, and we've always welcomed immigration. You know, there's been a long history going back, not just, you know, hundreds of years, but even more. I mean, you've had areas where you've had, you know, people working on the ships coming in and settling here. You've had, obviously, the Huguenots from France. You've had people from other areas in Europe. You've had people from the Commonwealth, people from India, people from Africa, like Nigeria, Ghana, places like that, people from the Caribbean. So Britain has always had immigration, and Britain always will have immigration, yeah? But the problem, what happened with the European Union, yeah, is the European Union became like a free-for-all. You had an open door to nearly 500 million people, and there was absolutely no control. You know, anyone could come without any restrictions or without being asked any questions or without having to apply for anything. And this system, you know, clearly cannot work, and it's clearly unsustainable because obviously, you know, on the one hand, the previous system which had existed in the past, you know, I'm the son of immigrants. My parents were immigrants when they came here. They obviously applied in the normal way, applied possibly for a work permit or a visa, and then obviously then stayed on and then, you know, became naturalized citizens. And this is the way many people have done it in the past. And hopefully once we return to a sensible immigration policy, we'll start to do it again.
But what we've seen, Khalid, from what you're saying is, we've seen that open door policy actually drive down wages, make living standards all the poorer in the country. I mean, Oxfam have talked about the rate of child poverty here. You know, it's never been as high as it is. I'm not trying to blame immigrants. Immigrants never made these policies.
No,
you know,
absolutely not.
I'm an immigrant. I'm from the Republic of Ireland. I'm an immigrant in this country. You're the son of immigrants. Immigrants did not make these policies, and immigrants should not be made to feel threatened or treated in a hostile way. Bureaucrats made these decisions. So wages were driven down, living standards went down, Khalid, and undoubtedly public services were driven to the point where they're on the verge of collapse. Here's the question. You know who you're talking to now. Were those decisions made for two reasons? One, to keep us all fighting one another, while globalists could eventually, ultimately, privatise everything. I remember interviewing Noam Chomsky some years ago, and Chomsky, I'm not dropping names here, but Chomsky said, in order to privatise something, destroy it. Is that what we've seen? Is that the reason why we've seen what's happened in the last 25, 30 years? Or one of the reasons?
I think what's happened is we've had a loss of our identity. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, you had things like, you know, the Silver Jubilee, you used to have things like the Royal Wedding, you used to have things where people would be, you know, proud to be English, proud to be British, proud to be Scottish, proud to be Welsh, proud to be Irish, etc. And obviously, you know, we'd have the home international football tournaments, you know, there'd be lots of things where we could express ourselves and be proud of being whatever we were. Now, that has actually been taken out of our society now. Now people are almost like ashamed to show the flag, ashamed to say I'm English or I'm British or I'm Scottish or I'm Welsh or I'm Irish, etc. You know, they are kind of like melded into a pan-European identity, which doesn't actually exist. And another thing is with the open door to the rest of Europe, what's happened is Britain has lost a way of controlling this, because you see, there is no quality control. You could have a situation where a person comes out of prison in one particular jurisdiction, flies on a plane, comes here, and straight away is accepted or she's accepted. And there's absolutely no control. And that's just very, very silly on the one hand. And it's, you know, very damaging to the society. Now, I mean, let's look at this from the other side of the coin as well. Those countries where the immigrants are coming from, I'm talking about the rest of Europe, let's say Lithuania, Bulgaria, Romania, etc. We are actually destroying their economies as well, because by taking the people of working age, by taking the brightest and the best from their countries, we're actually reducing their tax pay base. We're reducing their population as well. And we're actually effectively doing colonization by reverse. And it's actually very damaging for many of those countries, because, you know, they've now got a brain drain. They've now got, drain of all their taxpayers, and they're unable to service their own economies.
Multiculturalism has failed us, the people. I don't want to call us the plebs, the ordinary folk, but it has done. But it served the agenda, the elite, the globalists, hasn't it? It served them, because ultimately, I watch social media, I listen to other independent radio programmes, and the hatred that's out there amongst people of different ethnic groups, all blaming one another, and we're not blaming the people responsible for it, right?
Look, companies, for example, like Starbucks, it suits them because they get a load of cheap workers for their thousands of coffee shops up and down the country. Businesses which are, you know, global businesses, it suits them because they get cheap labor. They're able to avoid jurisdiction in any one country, so they avoid paying taxes. And often they also avoid paying the employment taxes. I mean, we've seen the recent court cases with companies like Uber, for example. You know, Uber came from America. It's got registration in Luxembourg. It's got another registration in Holland.
Yeah.
And it's now become a huge monster in the UK, but it pays no tax, doesn't even pay VAT, doesn't provide its employees with any employment rights, such as sick pay, holiday pay, or anything like that. But not only that, it doesn't even provide its employees with the basics, like a toilet or a restroom. So, I mean, you know, this is absolutely, you know, terrible. And the problem is, it's the people who tend to be like, you know, the Lib Dems, the Labour Party, etc. They kind of like want more integration into Europe. But you see, Europe and the European Union, as it's been working for the benefit of corporations. These mega corporations are actually involved in the writing of the European legislation.
Of course they are. And people need to hear this. By the way, I've got to do a quick recap. This is vital. It might sound like a very rude interruption because you're getting to something very important.
No problem.
But this is important. It's 21 minutes to the top of the air. Khalid Khan is on the line. Khalid is a UKIP member. He's a previous candidate for them in local elections. Might stand in the general election. He's the vice chairman of the Barnet branch. Really important to have him on. You're coming to something really important. We're talking about the centralisation centralization of power. It works for the benefit of corporations. And you were just about to talk about how massive international companies owned by some of the biggest banks in the world basically draft and write legislation that MEPs can do nothing about. Talk about that.
Well, MEPs actually have no power.
None.
I mean, it's none at all. Everything is decided by the European Commission and the unelected, I like to call them the Politburo of Europe, yeah? And what happens is the big corporations meet them, lobby them, you know, effectively bribe them, should we say, and cajole them into making certain changes to laws and writing new laws, which basically mean that small companies have to pass a lot of hurdles and a lot of obstacles, a lot of red tape, which big multinational corporations don't have to follow the same rules. So you have situations, for example, recently Kraft took over Cadbury's in the UK. They then started shifting a lot of Cadbury production to Poland, where it's cheaper to manufacture and stuff. And now, you know, you've got a situation now where, you know, they've changed the ingredients of their products. A lot of people are saying, oh, I'm not going to buy that anymore because it's not the same as it used to be. And, you know, the prices have gone up, the portion sizes have gone down, the quality's gone down. But you see, as a multinational company, they can write laws and legislation to suit them. Google is another example. I mean, Google now is a virtual monopoly on the internet.
Yes.
You know, apart from Google, you don't really have any other search opportunities. And Google can actually decide, you know, what you look at. And, you know, that's actually a situation which is now becoming very, very bad, because obviously they're interfering in elections. They're interfering in, they certainly interfered in the Brexit campaign. You know, this is it. You know, you've got a situation where big corporations now stick their nose into politics and into policy and are, you know, effectively telling us what we can and can't choose. And, you know, this is one of the fundamental reasons why we need to get our sovereignty back ASAP.
Khalid, it's brilliant to have you on. Fascinated by reading your Twitter over the last few weeks. We'll come to one or two things in a few minutes. We've got about 15 minutes left, even 20 max, because we've got to move on then at the top of the hour. I'm delighted that you're on the program. I'm fascinated because, considering your, you know, very much mainstream position within UKIP, you're courageous in some of the things you talk about, and you're willing to go down these roads that maybe a lot of people, you know, in public life are not willing to go down and talk about these things. What you've been describing there, and I talked about it last night briefly with Norman Baker, AFRICOM, NAFTA, the European Union, the central banks and the very, very tiny elite, they ultimately want to centralise power, right? It's much easier to control the majority of us when we, you know, have to accede to or bend our knee to these massive economic and political unions. That's definitely true. Now, a couple of quick questions. Your leader, I mean, I don't vote. You might find that strange. You might not. I don't believe in the electoral process. I'd like to see it all done away with, to be honest, but that's for another day. I like what you're saying. I'm not overly enamoured of your leader. I don't like him. I don't like him for two reasons. Number one, he's a bit of a flip-flopper. He's gone on record in the past as talking about the possible need to make some services paid-for services on the National Health Service. This is a big, big issue, this. He's since backtracked on that and said, no, if UKIP were to have a massive election this time around, or in 2022, or if there's another snap election between then, is it your position that the NHS is sacrosanct? It should never be sold off to any company, and it should always be free at the point of entry for those who need it. God knows we pay enough bloody taxes in this country. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we're all customers, also users of the NHS, and one of the things is UK policy is that NHS should always be free at the point of use, and we should always have access to it. Now, there are things that have happened over the last few years, the last, let's say, since 1997, when Tony Blair came to power. Obviously, one of those is the PFI, the Private Finance Initiatives, which actually created a situation where NHS trusts had to lease buildings of private companies, had to buy services of private companies, had to effectively lose money and pay huge amounts out of the system to private companies. Many of them were donors to the Labour Party. And what happened is that's created a lot of debts and a lot of losses for the NHS, which is money that could have been used on delivering healthcare. So UKIP is opposed to the PFIs, and we would look to roll them back and get rid of them altogether, because we don't believe that there is any benefit in PFIs to the NHS. We also believe that we would be able to generate more revenue for the NHS because of this system that exists at the moment. You see, at the moment, people come from all over the world, make use of the NHS, and actually have not paid anything into it. So what we would do is we would make a system where if you come to the UK for whatever reason, holiday visa, student visa, etc., you'd have to buy health insurance. And I don't think that's anything wrong, because if we go to a different country, we have to buy health insurance as well, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, we could debate that. I see where you're coming from. Look, if somebody's here on holiday and they slip and hurt their head and they've got to be taken to the emergency room, they're a guest in our country. They're spending money in our country, probably a lot of money. I'm saying stitch them up, give them a lollipop and thank them for coming to the UK. Don't charge them. Okay, you know, that's what I would say.
I'll give you an example. There was a recent case. You might be familiar with it or maybe not, but there was a UK holidaymaker who went to Bulgaria. And he was injured. He had to get treatment. Unfortunately, he didn't have health insurance and they wouldn't treat him. And his family tried to raise the money to have him flown back to the UK in an air ambulance. And it was going to cost something like $25,000 to do that. They managed to raise the money, but unfortunately, by the time they got the money, he had actually died. Now, you see, what happens is our NHS, our system, you know, we're obviously very fair and we treat everyone.
Fair enough.
But when people from Britain travel to other countries, you know, they don't get the same treatment back. And it's just a simple thing is if people were to stop using the NHS as a tourist, they'd effectively have to get health insurance when they come here. That would actually reduce the burden on the NHS by several billion a year, which would then be able to be reinvested in providing more services.
Now, I can agree. I can agree with that. There is an issue that no political party wants to touch. You don't need to be nervous about what I'm going to say now, because I've mentioned this to Nigel Farage in the past. I've mentioned it to Roger Helmer, to Hamilton, to everybody who's been on this programme over the years from UKIP. If we nationalised, and I mean properly nationalised, the Bank of England, and if we were creating, if our government was issuing debt-free currency where it's needed and not borrowing from central banks, right, we wouldn't have to worry about paying back deficits and billions and trillions of pounds in years to come. And when I've mentioned this to people, they don't want to touch it. Now, the economist Steve Keen was on the show a couple of weeks back. He's world famous, and he agrees with it up to a point. If we were issuing our own currency, you talk about sovereignty, Khalid, even if we come out of the European Union, even if we leave the customs union and all of that, and if we did that properly, we're still not sovereign when our government has to go and borrow money from a bank, which loans the money into existence and then charges us astronomical interest on it. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, one of the things is borrowing has obviously always existed, yeah? But the question is really the interest, or what they call usury in the past, yeah? Now, in the past, governments would be able to issue debt, you know, in the form of bonds and gilts. You know, they'd sometimes call it a war loan, etc. And, you know, obviously there had to be some kind of coupon on that to encourage the investor to invest. So, I mean, whether you're issuing the debt as a government or whether you're borrowing from the Bank of England or from any other institution, in a way, debt always plays a part in the economy.
Yeah, but it wouldn't. Hang on a second, Khalid. It wouldn't. Why should a sovereign government in a country like the United Kingdom or in a country like England, why should it need to borrow from anybody particularly when the financial institutions it borrows from isn't actually loaning it anything other than a loan that only comes into existence the minute it's issued. I've gone a weird way about explaining that. We talk a lot about this on the programme. Why would they need to do that? Why would they not pay for services by issuing debt-free currency of their own? Nobody wants to talk about this, but it's massive. It goes to the heart of how the European Central Bank has taken over Europe, right? Go ahead.
I mean, sorry, but I'll just give you an example. You know the history of the Weimar Republic. Obviously, you can hyperinflate when you're issuing debt-free currency and you keep on issuing more and more and more and spending. You know, you hyperinflate and you end up with a currency that becomes worthless.
Not necessarily. I'm going to stop you right there now. I didn't think we'd be arguing. We're not going to argue. I'm going to stop you right there. Not necessarily, because I'm not talking about quantitative easing. I'm not talking about printing loads of money and throwing it at society. I'm not. I'm talking about the government writing checks to building companies in this country to go and build the essential public housing that people need, that low-income families need, because they can't afford to buy a house. And you do that, and obviously that is going to create an enormous boom in the economy. And it's not going to cause hyperinflation, because you're putting money only into essential public services that you're not borrowing from a rogue financial institution, a central bank, which as I said is only inventing that money at the point of issuing the loan anyway. So I'm not talking about quantitative easing. I'm talking about, why should the government have to borrow from anybody, you know, particularly when money doesn't exist anyway? You know, it's not backed by anything. You know this, right? There's no gold standard.
I understand. I mean, you know, currencies, as they're called, fiat currencies, you know, none of them these days has any asset backing it. You know, the only value that the currency has is what somebody is prepared to pay for it. And that's compared to other currencies. Now, I mean, an interesting thing on the same subject, but slightly different. In the world today, there are actually only a handful of countries which have this system where they have their own in-house central bank and they issue their own currency. One of those countries, interestingly enough, is Syria.
It is.
Which is obviously under attack you know, from all directions. And that may be one of the reasons that they are under attack, because you know, having independence from the system makes them a target. And, you know, it would be a very, very brave politician or a prime minister or chancellor or whatever who would go down that road, because obviously there are vested interests, obviously. There are.
Yes, he'd be killed, is what you're saying. Well, you're not saying that. Listen, I'll tell you what.
I'm saying as a policy, it is something which is interesting. A lot of people have thought about it. A lot of people have thought, yes, why don't we do this? I mean, I've said that to Donald Trump as well. Donald Trump, now you've become the president, why don't you issue your own debt-free currency? Why don't you, you know, nationalize the Federal Reserve, take it under U.S. government control, and then start issuing debt-free currency.
But Khalid, do you know what happened? They showed him the Zapruder film. They showed him the Zapruder film and said, listen, we'll have no more talk about going after the Fed. I could kiss you for what you just said there about Syria, by the way. And I want to talk briefly about Syria before we run out of time. And thanks for coming on the program. I'm enjoying the conversation. Khalid Khan is on the line. You can follow him on Twitter. It's at Khan UKIP, at K-H-A-N UKIP. Barnett Vice Chairman and former local election candidate for UKIP. He talks a lot of sense. I like what you've been saying on Twitter about what's happening in Syria. And you've touched on it there. What's going on? How do you read that?
Okay, I mean, it's obviously a very bad situation for the people of Syria. It's a bad situation for the entire Middle East. Obviously, Syria, until a few years ago, was effectively one of the best countries in the Middle East. You could even say, you know, the one of the few bright sparks. It's a secular country. It's made up of, you know, Christians, Muslims, Druze, Shiites, Sunnis, Alawites, all different ethnic minorities and all different religions. And everyone lived peacefully side by side, everyone coexisted. Now, what happened was, now this, I don't know if you've heard this before or not, but this is another war over resources. Syria has a part of Syria called the Golan Heights, which currently half of that is occupied by Israel. Now, there was a massive oil discovery underneath that. And obviously, as an occupied land, you can't extract the resources from it because it doesn't actually belong to you. There was another oil discovery off the coast, which is known as the Leviathan oil field. I don't know if you've heard of it, but you can look it up on Google or something. It's a massive oil deposit on the East Mediterranean, which actually goes from Syria, it traverses Cyprus, and it also goes down Lebanon and Israel. So you see, Syria is a land that has got massive resource potential. There's also the issue of pipelines. Now, what happened was Saudi Arabia and Qatar both wanted to build a pipeline. Obviously, Saudi Arabia has a lot of oil. Qatar has access to a lot of gas. And they wanted to build pipelines which would cross Syria, come through Turkey into Europe. And the thing is, the Syrian government decided they'd rather go with their a plan from the Russians and the Iranians to build their pipeline. And as soon as this happened, then, you know, obviously that's when the war drum started beating, unfortunately. So it's very similar to all the other wars. It's another war over resources. What the media reports, unfortunately, a lot of that is just downright lies.
Downright lies. Do you know, it's incredible you're talking about this. You're absolutely right. You're right to say that that resources play a part in it. It does. I think it's far deeper than that, but I won't get into that here. But you're right to talk about that. And when you talk about downright lies, we have a foreign minister, and I'm glad to see you tweeting about him. Well, we're not going to have time to talk about George Osborne, sadly. We might do that another time.
But, okay, that'll be good.
But that'll be good fun. But we have a foreign minister. We basically have elected officials knowingly lying through their teeth. And lies so grave, Khalid, that might result in a protracted confrontation with Russia, with China, maybe with Iran, that could cost millions of lives. And that's not an exaggeration. These people should be impeached, shouldn't they? These liars, Johnson and his ilk?
Yeah, I mean, they should be. I mean, it's actually shocking. I mean, just to reiterate, UKIP has a total 100% non-intervention policy. We opposed the war in Iraq. We opposed the invasion of Afghanistan. We opposed the invasion and the overthrow in Libya. If you think about all the migrant crisis that happens today, all the people crossing the Mediterranean boats, that is simply because of the collapse of the Libyan government and the takeover. Now, the same thing in Syria. UKIP 100% opposes any intervention into Syria. You know, it's none of the UK's concern. It's none of the USA's concern. And, you know, in actual fact, you know, the UK and USA has been supplying the so-called moderate rebels, which actually I don't consider them to be moderate at all. There's no such thing as a moderate terrorist. But the thing is, you know, the UK and the US has been helping them, has been supplying them with lethal as well as non-lethal weapons, and has been backing them politically. And the thing is, you know, I'm one of the people who believes, as does many in the leadership of UKIP, that, you know, we should stay out of this. But if anything, we should be supporting President Assad. Look, President Assad, many people don't understand this. You know, he was a doctor working in the NHS in London.
That's right.
An eye doctor. His wife, Asma, was actually born in London. She's born in Acton. She's British. You know, so the thing is, these are Western secular people who, you know, we should be friends with. You know, why should our government support people who are going around chopping people's heads off and gassing people, et cetera, et cetera? Why aren't we supporting the legitimate government of Syria in its struggle to free its country from these terrorists?
Khalid, I could spend the rest of the program talking to you. It's great to have you on the show, mate. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
No, anytime. Do drop us a line and let us know what happens in your neck of the woods, and if you're going to stand in the election, I'd like to know that. Really no appreciate your thoughts and your honesty and your opinions. Good luck with everything. It's at Khan UKIP on Twitter. That's where you follow Khalid. Really fascinating, mate. Thanks for doing it, and look after yourself.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff. Khalid Khan on the line to us there from his home, I think, in Barnet. Fascinating guy is Khalid. It's exactly a minute to the top of the hour. Huge interest in this on Twitter, particularly all that talk about usury, about central banks, about Syria. Refreshing to hear a politician who's likely to stand for UKIP, by the way, soon, talking about these things. I shouldn't have to say this now because the programme has been on for 2.5 years. We ain't gone all mainstream on you, and I'm not advocating voting in elections, something I don't do myself, because of reasons we've gone into too many times. But I like individual people like that. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, because we had Norman Baker on last night, the immigration issue, what was sold to the people of the United Kingdom last year. Most people, I think, voting on immigration lines. The desire by Farren and others to stay in the single market is all about tearing up, basically, the mandate given to the government by the British people to stop the open-door immigration policy that has driven down wages, that has severely impacted public services in this country, undoubtedly. And I'm not going to say I'm not racist, but we've said it too many bloody times on this programme. People from different ethnic backgrounds and who've come to this country are not responsible for it. Never have been. It's a whole other agenda responsible for that. Fascinating to hear him talk about that. Right, it's exactly a minute past the hour. Going to take some music. Joining me in a few minutes' time, a woman I can't wait for you to meet, an educational psychologist, a former civil servant, former primary and secondary school teacher, has worked here in Lancashire with the education. She's worked in educational psychology here in Lancashire, and she's got a lot of fascinating opinions about children in schools, child education, the medication of children, and much more. You don't want to miss her. She joins me in a couple of minutes' time. Right. In the meantime, here's some music from The Jam. This is A Town Called Malice on The Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com at exactly 2 minutes past the hour on Wednesday, April 19th. Good to be with you.
To important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device. Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smart smart phone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Virtually every transaction that involves a child is valuable to somebody.
We intend to show everyone the real reason children are being removed at an alarming rate.
No, this is awful.
The baby's not been seen by the dots or nothing.
They are psychopathic.
They have got the legal right to kill children now, because that's what they do.
Traffic 2, available now at premiumonpictures.co.uk.
Right, you're very welcome back to the programme. It's exactly 5.5 minutes past the hour. It is Wednesday, April 19th, 2017. Broadcasting live around the world on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, alternatecurrentradio.com and TuneIn Radio. Do check out our broadcast partners. Terrific programmes on Fab Radio here in this great city on Alternate Current Radio as well. And I recommend you bookmark davidicke.com/headlines because the stories we talk about on this programme are covered in great detail and in great depth on the on the website on davidicke.com/headlines. Now, I'm excited about our next guest. I really am. She got in touch with me while I was away on holiday. She emailed me. She was talking about the Supreme Court decision that John Platt was wrong to take his children out of school and the implications of that and what it meant. She's an incredibly qualified woman. I mentioned this on social media today. Her credentials are fairly impeccable. She's an educational psychologist with degrees in environmental science and a master's in psychology itself. I mentioned her extensive resume. I've synopsized it. She's taught at primary and secondary schools. She's also worked in local government. She's been a civil servant. Now, we're going to talk about a lot of things, the psychological effects of schools on children, children's mental health, the medication of children, vaccines, Wi-Fi and much more. Delighted that she's on the line to us tonight. Let's welcome to the programme Catherine Hannaford. Catherine, you're very welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Good evening, Richie. Lovely to talk to you.
It's lovely that you reached out. I'd like to claim credit for finding people like you, but sometimes you just land on our doorstep and you reached out to us, which was marvellous, while I was on holiday.
Well, I had been on, I managed to get on to Any Answers the Saturday before last on BBC Radio 4, where they were debating that court case, you know, and the chap taking his kids to, or his daughter, whoever it was, to Disneyland during term time. And I just thought, you know, things are going a bit far, really, with children now. Yes, if you're in and out of schools a lot, and I've literally sat in a very privileged position in hundreds of classrooms over the years, watching what's going on between the kids with the teaching and everything else, you know. And you do see a lot firsthand, and you know how difficult it is for teachers because they're either stood in front of a class teaching, or they're preparing the work, or they're marking the work, or they're setting up tests, or they're having their lesson plans passed by somebody else, or they're record keeping. You know, they're on the go all the time, and you can appreciate why people get upset about children not being there all the time. But there's a myriad of reasons why a parent might need to take their child out of school during term time. You know, maybe a grandmother's ill or dying, maybe they're thinking of immigrating and they need to go and have a look somewhere. Maybe the parent themselves can't get time off in the school holidays because that's their busiest time. So there's a whole lot of valid reasons why sometimes it's unavoidable. And my suggestion was, why don't they come to an agreement, you know, where the school says, well, if you decide you're taking your child out during the term time, here's what we'll be covering, because they've got the lesson plans down to the day and the hour. We need you to understand that you now have responsibility for teaching that. And of course, the lady in Anita Anand jumped in and said, oh, well, that wouldn't be worth the paper it's written on. And I thought, that's really rude, because most parents are more than, you know, keen that their kids get on. They just want the best for their children, and they go out of their way to help them. So I think to put parents down like that and say, oh, it wouldn't be worth the paper it's written on, the parents wouldn't do it.
And on that BBC,
it's really unfair, you know.
It is unfair. And on that BBC programme that you managed to get onto, when you mentioned this, they very quickly kind of moved you along. And I don't know how much
well,
that,
I think they moved me along, Rich, because I then said, I think we've got to the stage in, you know, education where, you know, whose children are they? Why shouldn't a parent have the right to go away for a couple of weeks if they deem it necessary, whether it's because they can't afford to go at any other time or whether it's for a reason of family illness or whatever else? They shouldn't be needing to go to a head teacher cap in hand and saying, please, please, sir, please, miss, can I take my child out of school for a couple of weeks? You know, they've got the responsibility as parents to know whether it's necessary or not, let them get on with it. And I then went on to give the example of, I don't know if you remember, but I think it was the summer before last, there was a couple of fairly well-educated parents, well-read. They took their young son out of a cancer hospital to take him to where they had a second home, which I think was in Spain.
That's right.
And they wanted to get a different, what they regarded as a better cancer treatment there. They were pursued across Europe by Interpol like a bunch of criminals. And I just, you know, I just sort of mentioned that. Well, I think that's what they didn't let me mention. I'm not sure. But anyway, I was basically just trying to make the point, whose children are they? We bear them, we feed them, we clothe them, we bring them up, all at our own expense. And increasingly, we seem to be in a position where we're being told we can't do things with our own children. We can't make decisions about their health if it contradicts what the mainstream medical view is. We can't take them out of school if it contradicts what that particular head teacher thinks. And they were also saying, oh, leave it to the head teacher. But if you've got a child in one school and his sister or brother's in another school, you might get one head teacher that will say fine and another one that doesn't say fine. So where does that leave you?
Where does
head
that leave
teachers
the parent?
Are not all the same as each other. Some, I've met head teachers that are incredibly empathic and would do the best they could all the time. I've also met head teachers whose own staff consider them to be bullies.
You are, so, Catherine,
are you
you're uniquely...
Are you going to leave it to that individual, you know?
Yeah, you're uniquely placed, more than anybody who's ever been on this programme, to comment on these issues because of your work as a psychologist. I want to mention again, not because I'm buttering up Catherine, it's important that you understand she's eminently qualified.
I'm not
qualified.
Much of an egotist.
Yeah. No, you're eminently qualified and you've also taught in primary and secondary school. So here's the question. What sort
and home
of,
tuition as well.
And home tuition as well.
And visual impairment and special needs. So I've actually done quite a wide... And environmental education as well. So.
Like I said, nobody better qualified. At least it's been on... And I've had teachers on this programme. And I'm not going to have a go at teachers because I like teachers.
Oh, they're fabulous people.
Fabulous
they work
people.
So hard.
Tell me this, Catherine. What sort of environment... You've looked at this over a period of 2 or 3 decades.
Sure.
When we send a child to school now, what environment... are they going into? Are they going into an environment where they can grow and learn and be creative and express themselves and find things out for themselves? Or is there something very different going on? And I'm not blaming teachers at all. I want to get that out there straight away. What's happening to our children?
Do you mean in terms of an agenda?
Yes, that's exactly. Look, I'm not going to hide behind. That's exactly what I mean. What's happening to our children? What should be happening is what should be happening to them actually happening? Are they going into schools and getting a chance to explore, to express, to be themselves, to be individual?
Well,
or is there something else
I'd
going
like
on?
To say is no two schools are the same. You could go into literally dozens, if not hundreds of different schools and there'll be a different atmosphere, there'll be different leadership, there'll be different priorities. You know, although the national curriculum has, since 1990, has standardised a lot, there is still huge variation between schools because of personalities, because of even things like school layout can affect how things are done. You know, some schools have good common spaces that lots of them can gather together in, and some of them really struggle, and the only place they can use is the dinner hall sort of thing, you know. So, I mean, it varies hugely, and it varies according to the age, experience of the teacher as well. In primary school, you're mostly, almost exclusively dealing with female teachers. There's very, very, very few male teachers in primary. They're mostly drawn to secondary work. But, you know, they go in the morning, they all sit on, if they're young enough, they all sit on the carpet, they go through the registration where they learn to, you know, nod at the right time to authority when it's their time to say their name and acknowledge that they're there. Then they'll, usually in the mornings, they'll do either maths and English, so sort of literacy or numeracy, as we call it now. So they do the harder stuff, the more basic stuff in the morning. And then in the afternoon, there'll be a variety of less and less creative stuff than there used to be. And also it depends on the age of the child. In nursery, it's all very, still all very play-oriented, as it should be. But then we do send our children to school at a ridiculously young age here, whereas in some Scandinavian countries, they don't go till they're seven or nearly seven, because they think that play environment, they shouldn't be going in and learning, you know, sort of things that are all left brain activity from a really young age. So, I mean, it's questionable nowadays how much of the right brain is being developed, because the pressure that's in the curriculum, and teachers just don't have the freedom that they used to have. You know, they're pressed into quite a tight curriculum, and the sort of freedom that they used to have for spotting the individual differences of children, their talents and skills, and trying to develop them, that's not handled in the same way now either, because there's just so much to get through. But yeah, I mean, I think there's still inquiring, questioning environments, but not quite in the same way they would have been certainly when I was at school, although, I mean, I started school in 1960, I think. So, I mean, we got our little boxes of threading beads and a wee thing to do arithmetic in, and a wee bit of, and a lot of writing and handwriting practice and reading practice. But we certainly learned how to spell and read and knew our similes and all the basic stuff, you know. And the talking now is a thing you notice the young kids too. A lot of children come in, especially to reception or to nursery, and they don't actually know how to behave with other kids. They have been sat at home, either spoiled and pandered to, or put in front of a screen a lot of the time. Or sometimes you see children trying to talk to their parents, and their parents are on their mobile phones and not really paying any attention to the child. So we get kids coming in now who cannot sit through a story. They can't sit on the carpet with the rest of their classmates and listen to a story. They'll get bored and they'll get up after 5 minutes and just stand up and walk away. They've got no concept of being part of a group. So things have changed a lot over the years, and teachers do their best, but they do their best with a very variable intake. Some parents will spend a lot of time socializing and teaching their children, and some parents don't. And I think the other thing we see a lot of, I see this all the time when I'm observing in classrooms, children yawning, had the wee dark shadows under their eyes, and they can't, you know, they can't concentrate properly because they haven't had enough sleep. Now, whether that's because the home environment's noisy, or they've been dragged down to the supermarket at 10 o'clock at night and they haven't had enough, you know, they haven't basically been in their bed long enough, whether it's the quality. I mean, I'm a great nutritionist as well. I've got nutritional therapy training as well, nutritional healing training, and I see a lot of children now that I just think basically they're not eating the right kind of food. Some of it is fast foods, all the junk that's in food now, you know, the sort of, I don't know, binders, fillers that you get, like you get in pills and drugs as well. There's a lot of that sort of stuff in food now.
And that's having a huge impact on children, that. And I want to move...
Herbicides, pesticides, antibiotics coming through the food, both on vegetables and on meat, you know. And they're taking all these things in, and they're not detoxing properly. So they're getting too much poor nutritional quality food, and basically your brain's not going to work as well, or your body generally is not going to work as well on that. And you know, we've got a lot of more pollution in the air now as well. And you know,
now can we leave that for a second, Catherine? Can we come back in a second, in a few minutes, to the nutrition thing, because I want to touch on a couple of things that you got into. You talked about the nodding and the acquiescence of the child to authority in school. And then you moved on to something interesting. You moved on to children sitting in front of a screen.
They do that in school now too.
They do that in school as well, right?
A lot of the deliveries on PowerPoints and various things on a great big screen on the wall now. So,
and they have tablets.
The old chalk and talk is gone, and the sort of demonstration stuff is less as well.
So they're exposed to mobile phone technology and tablets increasingly. On our brief week off last week, we spent a couple of days, just 2 days, in the Lake District. We were stunned at the amount of young children in buggies, I swear to all that's sacred, that were using tablets. Children were using tablets while being rolled along in a buggy. Now, it's been said that this technology and the exposure to it is in some way reshaping the brains or the minds of our children. Do you go along with that? Do you see that?
I do, yeah. I certainly think it's not, you know, the microwaves that come off of phones are not good for you. And I mean, that's why I asked if you could phone me on a landline and not on a mobile phone, because I personally don't like talking on mobile phones any more than I absolutely have to. And I know my daughter, when she uses her now, she plugs in little earphones that she puts in her ears and keeps the phone a couple of feet away from her. I never sleep with my phone nearer than 8 feet away from me at night, and usually I switch it off and leave it downstairs so it's nowhere near me. But children, all these children that I see that are falling asleep in school, a lot of them have TVs in their bedrooms now, because sometimes when you're sort of doing it one-to-one work with children, you'll say to them, I bet when your mum and dad goes down the stair and you've turned your TV off, you've got a remote control, haven't you? And they go, yeah. And I said, I bet when they've gone out of sight and out of earshot, you flip that back on and you watch the telly. How do you know that? They say, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all doing it. They're all, you know, unless you take the plug out the wall, switch it off, take the plug out the wall so that you can hear them plugging that back in downstairs when they do it. They'll all be watching it, and they're watching things to too late. The actual phones themselves and tablets, obviously Wi-Fi is quite a big issue now. Some people are far more sensitive to that kind of energy than others. Another thing that's coming in now is these smart meters. Some people can't be near them. I've refused to have them in my house because I know a number of people get health issues with being connected with these sort of technologies. And I've been hearing that the new 5G, when it comes out, is going to be a huge jump in, I think it's measured in megahertz, I'm not sure, but it's going to be a huge jump from the 4G to the 5G. There was quite a jump from 3 to 4, and there's going to be a massive jump to 5G, and it's going to be really serious. Particularly, it's for children, it's particularly so because their brains are in development. So any effect of microwaves, I mean, if you look at pictures of people's heads when they are on a mobile phone, you can see the microwaves going further and further into the head. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's all been hushed up, as indeed has the whole thing around microwave ovens. I threw out my microwave about 12 or 13 years ago now, after I read research on that and the changes, the carcinogenic changes it made to foods. So, I mean, I'm quite aware of all these things, but I don't think a lot of people are.
You're very unique, Catherine, because...
You think?
Well, you are, because, look, I mentioned this to you today. This is not about kissing your backside. I said this to you today when we spoke. You, I have to say this again, it's not about buttering up, Catherine. This lady's credentials are absolutely impeccable. And for you to be talking about these things, to be talking about the rewiring of children's brains with these gadgets, this network of Wi-Fi, this all-encompassing grid that we're seeing, and the damage that it's doing, these things, there is nobody in your profession with your experience talking about these issues. And I know you're retired. You're a young woman, let's be honest. You are a young woman, but you're retired. You said to me today, that, and I want to talk about vaccines shortly. You said to me today, I don't think it's unfair to mention, you came up to Manchester in January to have a look at David Icke's all-day presentation.
Yeah, four of us came, yeah.
Now, when he talked about this particularly, as he does in detail, I think in the third section of the talk that he does, and he talks about how all of this comes together, the terrible food and what's in the foods, the Wi-Fi, all these things. Do you go along with that? Feel free to criticise it or disagree with it, of course. Do you go along with that? Do you see that in your own expertise, in your own studies of children?
I get the kind of feeling that there's an overall push to make people feel helpless. If you think back to when you were younger, everything seemed to be more straightforward than it is nowadays. You had one lot of people supplying you with gas, with electricity. You could pick up the phone and dial 192 and get directory inquiries. It was free. BT ran the phones. Do you know, you knew how everything stood. Do you know, now I couldn't even tell you who's supplying my gas and electricity. I changed it online and I can't even remember who they are. I don't get physical bills. I get things by email now and again, which if I miss them, I miss them. You know, as the emails go by in increasing numbers. I just feel there's a kind of, with the education, I mean, a lot of people who've been in education a lot of years as well would say that the teachers coming in now are not as individual as the people who used to be teachers. They're more of a mould, of a kind. They're not expected to think so much for themselves other than in how they deliver the material they've been told to deliver. There's definitely been a change, you know, a bit more of a sausage meat thing about education. I mean, I was definitely educated. I was educated in Scotland and went to what was effectively the equivalent of a grammar school then, did three languages straight off the bat, you know, at age 11. We were definitely taught to think for ourselves. There was a real question more thing about it. It almost didn't matter whether you knew the answer to something or not. If you knew where to find it, if you knew how to find it out, if you knew how to make connections, that was a lot of the value of your education. If you knew how to mount an argument and, you know, sort of be able to defend your points of view. But that doesn't seem to be so important now. And I think schools have been pushed into a position, and I mean, there might be a lot of teachers will disagree with this, but with a kind of set curriculum, with all the kind of pressure that there is on league tables, and I mean, a league table only tells you very little about a school. It will tell you what results it's had for certain exams, whether that's stats or GCSEs or whatever it happens to be. It won't tell you what their emotional intelligence is like in the school. It won't tell you what their quality of caring. It won't tell you whether they turn out good all-round children. You'll need to talk to the parents of children who are already at that school to find out these things. So I think a lot of the pressure on the schools is certainly not coming from the schools. It's coming from above. I think a lot of things are coming. I feel a lot of things are coming from above now, you know, how we're allowed to go about things, whether we're allowed to take our child to our cancer treatment of choice, whether we're allowed to be out of school during the school holidays. So maybe it is connected. Maybe we're being fed rubbish food so that we can't think for ourselves as well. I don't know. I mean, that's hard to answer that, isn't it?
It is, but you've got great courage because you mentioned to me today, briefly you mentioned geoengineering and vaccines. And again, you know, coming from, I mean, you are proper establishment, Catherine. I mean, you are, and you know this.
Yes, but when you work through these jobs over years and years, you see a lot of things that break your heart, you know. I mean, if I think about it, it just makes me quite emotional, actually. I think of the number of parents over the years I've sat in a consultation with when I'm talking about their child, you know, whatever the issue is, whether it's a learning or a behaviour issue, and you're trying to get to the bottom of it and you're trying to make connections that will move the situation forward and help everybody out, help the school out, help the parents out, help the child out. So you end up getting quite close to the parents in that you start right from the pregnancy, the delivery, any issues, breastfeeding, developmental milestones, when they walked, when they first talked, all the rest of it. So you're building up a total picture of the child's development. And the number of parents over the years that have just that and literally told me that their child was never the same after they had their MMR. Right. You know, parents are not stupid. If their child was developing well and then they sort of suddenly regress or start to have seizures or react very violently to a vaccine. I mean, there's a lot of vaccine-damaged children around. It's never talked about. I'm not saying it's a high percentage, but they exist, and there's a compensation system for them. So we know they exist, and we've met parents who, you know, and I've just met quite a lot. And I think the thing that troubled me over the years, because I do believe in the truth and the truth coming out about things, is that the parents... I think I was one of the few professionals that they would actually broach the subject with, because they read me as being an authentic person that cared about their child and cared about listening to them and their story, their narrative. And I think because of that, they often felt comfortable enough to ask me or to bring the subject of vaccines up or the MMR or whatever it was. Whereas I don't think they felt comfortable doing that with a lot of professionals. And I think in some cases when they tried to broach it with a health professional, I mean of any level, you know, nurse to consultant and all stages in between, I think they get put down, they get talked down to, they get authoritarian sort of responses, they get the don't be stupid, they get, oh, you're an irresponsible parent if you don't want to vaccinate. They don't get an informed, scientifically research-based answer that makes them feel comfortable in their hearts and that makes them feel in their intuition, yeah, I'm happy with this, I'm happy to do this now. And there should be no reason why people who are well-informed about vaccines and are prepared to deliver them to very small babies, they should know everything there is to know about that vaccine. They should know the contents of it, including that a lot of vaccines contain aborted fetal tissue. They contain mercury or aluminium, or sometimes they're described as preservatives, but actually they're adjuvants, which means they're there to irritate the immune system so that they can give a smaller dose of the actual vaccine. So instead of giving a bigger dose of vaccine, which might cost more and may have biological issues to it as well. I don't know about how the body might react to a bigger dose of vaccine, but they put the adjuvants in so that they can use smaller amounts of the vaccine. Now, mercury and aluminium are totally toxic to the human body. And in some cases, they think that's what causes the damage and not the vaccine itself. There's also live DNA in some of them, which has been grown in different types of mammal, you know, sometimes monkeys, sometimes cows. I mean, the original name vaccine comes from cow, because vaca is a cow in Latin, and I think there's maybe a, I'm trying to think what the French for a cow is. Vache, isn't it? Vache. So that's where the word vaccine comes from. They used to use cows. I mean, I know I've read stuff about vaccines which would turn your stomach. I think they used to put cuts in the sides of cows, yeah, and put this stuff into them, and it has to grow on live tissue. So, I mean, and because of that, they got the simian virus from monkeys into vaccines at one point, and, oh, you know, it can be quite messy. So, but none of this, you know, this is all kept right down below the surface. Nobody's allowed to even ask or suggest, or they're told things about herd immunity that are not really accurate. They're told things about how vaccines pushed down the incidence of disease, which are not really accurate, because a lot of these diseases were tailing off anyway when the vaccines were introduced, and they were tailing off largely because of improvements in hygiene and overcrowding and all those sort of things. Actually, while we're on the subject of vaccines, can I just mention, Richie, there's a fabulous new documentary series out called The Truth About Vaccines. It's actually showing as we speak. Today is unfortunately the seventh episode, but I think what they usually do is over the next few days, they'll show it all free again. So if you look up, I've given you a link for it. I don't know whether you've put it up on your site or
you
not.
You have done, and I'm going to tweet it out and put it on Facebook. So
right,
it's going
so
to be
I've
there for
I've given you
everybody.
A link for that.
You
so
certainly
it's
have.
From the same makers of the Truth About Cancer. It's basically a documentary series where he's gone all over the world and interviewed people who are in favour of and not in favour of, who've got different views on, you know, cancer and vaccines. And they're all, you know, they're all leaders in their field. And he's basically interviewed them all and put it all in the one place so that people can hear the information firsthand and make up their own mind, which is
and make their own mind
be.
Up. Yeah, we like...
Not having our minds made up for us and told, this is how you should think about it, you know. Because none of these things are discussed, as you well know, on the mainstream media.
They're not. I'm going to do a quick recap, and I will put that link out there. Ty Bollinger, somebody we like a lot. Catherine Hannaford is on the line. It's exactly 26 minutes to the top of the hour. An educational psychologist. Catherine is retired, eminently qualified, degrees in environmental science and a master's in psychology. Worked everywhere in local government, Lancashire, here for years in educational psychology. Has taught at home, has taught in secondary schools and primary schools. I could be here all day talking about her resume. She's saying extraordinary things, not to you and to me, but extraordinary things from somebody with her background. She's had the courage to look into these issues and ask the sorts of questions, as she just said, that are not being asked on mainstream media. Now, a number of listeners have asked me to ask you, and the tweets are there for everybody to see, in case people think I make these questions up. The tweets are there. I've had Peter Tatchell. I like Peter a lot. He's a famous human rights campaigner. Peter is also gay, and he talks a lot about LGBT issues. Now, I had him on the program a few weeks ago, and we had a back and forth about the fact that children are being asked to entertain the idea of their gender. And this is true. This isn't scaremongering. We know this to be true. Peter said, I said, guys like you, Richie, you're looking to make a mountain out of a molehill. All we're teaching our children is to be kind to those that are different. Now, I beg to differ. And I believe that any discussion with primary school children, asking them to consider a list of different genders, there's something going on. Catherine, has this come up in your work over the years? And one of our listeners has asked to put this point to you. Surely it's damaging the development of children to be talking to them about these issues. And surely there's something darker and deeper going on there than just saying to children, oh, look, there are different people with different sexualities. We should let people be who they are and let, you know, live and let live. There's something more going on. What do you think?
I think it's fine to say that there are, when children get to a certain age, I don't think it's something you need to be doing while they're, you know, in the infants or you know, down the bottom end of the younger end of school. But as they start to ask questions themselves, I think that's always the best time to introduce it. I would have thought maybe the last couple of years of primary school, they'll be asking things by then. The trouble is, with access to the internet now, kids can look at almost anything. And that has brought a lot of stuff, especially exposure to pornography and everything, so that, you know, they're not quite sure what a bona fide, normal, loving relationship is anymore with some of the stuff that they get access to on the web. I think I know what you mean, but I think children have very, very strong strong identity with their own gender. I think possibly in the past, parents, without even realizing it, will have talked differently to their sons and daughters. They'd probably be quite horrified if you told them that, but I've certainly seen it a lot, you know, where a parent might react to a son in a completely different way from a daughter on the same issue. But I don't think you're going to successfully get children to think about people in an androgynous way. I think it's fine to say, you know, not all people are born the same in terms of their sexual orientation, and you shouldn't be mean to people, you shouldn't bully them, and you shouldn't make fun of them. They are what they are, and accept them the way they are, just like children accept kids with all sorts of different special educational needs and physical disabilities, now that they don't go to separate schools and they're all mixing in the same place, they just, you know, that child doesn't give you, doesn't, you know, invade your personal space and does things in a strange way, but that, they've grown up with them in primary school, so they accept that. So I think they're very good. Children are very good, provided their parents don't prime them otherwise. Children are very good at accepting people for what they are. But I'm not sure about, it's not something I've looked into, this attempt to make everybody talk in kind of non-male, female, androgynous ways. I think it will be unsuccessful, because I think it won't be backed up in the home environment. I think there's a difference between talking about everybody, talking about regarding everybody as some sort of androgynous being and being prepared to accept different people's sexuality and accepting people for what they are, whether it's some kind of disability, whether it's a sexual orientation. I mean, I've got friends of all kinds, all races, all, you know, all orientations, and they're just friends, you know. The androgynous thing, I don't know. I'd have to look into that a bit, Richie. It's not something It's not something I see every day in schools very much. No.
Yeah, my interest in it is that it's one of those things that was everywhere all of a sudden, and that's when you have to be suspicious. Everywhere, all of it. I mean, I've, again, talking to Peter about it, there's such a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of transgender men and women in the country. It's less than 0.002%.
Oh, I think it sort of went over the boundary when Obama tried to bring in these bathrooms for male and female. Yeah, I think they've knocked that back now, haven't they?
Well, Trump has apparently knocked it back.
One of the first things Trump changed, I think. Which I think is ridiculous. People don't want to feel uncomfortable going into, you know, what was once a female loo, and now they don't feel very comfortable anymore. I don't think that's right. But I think they might be right. There's maybe been a push to try and kind of androgynize things, but it's not something I see on an everyday basis.
We're going to talk for the next 10 minutes. We've got 10 minutes left. I want to talk about food.
Before we go on to that, Richie, can I just say on the phones, we sort of got onto the thing about Wi-Fi and phones and whether it fried your head.
Yeah.
But the other thing about phones is the more time children are spending on those, they're not interacting with people and they're not socialising. And that's what we see a lot of now with children coming into nursery and reception. You see children that don't know how to socialise properly with others. They're just living a little world of their own where things have been centred around them in the home environment, or maybe they've been ignored in the home environment. Obviously, children have lots of different experiences. But the emphasis there is now on parents using mobile devices, and children using mobile devices means they are not interacting with each other. They are not learning how to cooperate with, give consideration to, you know, they're just not learning how to interact with people in a face-to-face way.
And that's devastating, right? It's devastating
for
the future.
It's really, really important. It's horrifying, actually. Yeah. I dread to think what it means for the future, really, because that is the basis of communities and groups getting on with each other. You have to be able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and say, yeah, I get that. I don't agree with that, but I get that from your point of view. I see where you're coming from, you know. I can tolerate that view because I can understand it. If you live, and I mean, this happens with social media a lot now, you get people with all the same views who like each other, who do the same activities, and they end up all patting each other on the back and agreeing with each other in some sort of social bell jar, you know, where they'd never hear opinions outside their own little circle.
And of course,
a lot of people were shocked about Trump's victory because people talk to people that are like themselves on social media a lot of the time.
That's right, yeah. Debate is dead. Dissent is dead. Common conversation and exchanging ideas, even if you disagree with people, has
I hope we didn't get into too much on vaccines there, because I do think it's a subject you can't do in 5 minutes and you can't do in sound bites. It's a serious subject. It's a subject that, I was going to say, that makes people very emotional. Well, actually, I think it's been made into an emotional subject because people have been denied free information and debate on it. And now they think that it's my way or the highway. And actually, no, you have to realise that nowadays, I mean, I've got three science degrees. I'm, you know, very left-brained in a lot of ways. It's taken me quite a while to come back towards my right brain and my intuition and learn how valuable that is too. But science isn't what it used to be. We get a lot of what I'd call scientism now, which doesn't really use scientific method. It purports to, but what it is the use of science to actually justify the policies and the ideas and the products that you want to promote anyway. So we have drug companies doing research on their own products that they stand to make trillions.
That's right.
From
biotech,
which is
companies.
Wrong, completely wrong. We should have independent or governmental or some sort of organizations overseeing all these things, overseeing food standards and safety, overseeing agricultural standards and safety, but we don't. So we're trusting that these people are giving us GMO-free produce when they say they are, you know?
And they might
and
not.
And we're trusting that science has been carried out properly. Well, if you watch The Truth About Vaccines, you'll see how dodgy some of the science is. They're not even, you know, they're not even following the sort of gold standard of double-blind, placebo-controlled trials, because the placebos they're using are not saline solutions. They're solutions that have the aluminium adjuvant in them, for example. So they're not true placebos at all. There's a lot of things about it. I would just really encourage people to have a look at The Truth About Vaccines and make up their own mind. I don't require people to think the same as me. You
absolutely.
Know.
We're going to put the link out there. The link will be out there. Tell you what I'm going to do, because we're going to run out of time in less than five minutes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to invite you back on in a few weeks' time, and we'll have a longer segment, and we'll talk about the work that you do with food and nutrition specifically. But just for the last couple of minutes tonight, you're right about the vaccine, putting your head above the parapet as you've done now. I mean, look, I've spoken to medical doctors from the United States, from Ireland, here, who've got serious grave concerns and questions about the efficacy, number one, and the safety, number two, of vaccines. But as you've seen, Catherine, we talk to people who've been the victims of forced adoption in this country. People have had their children taken away, not because they've beaten the children or sexually abused the children, but in some cases because they've been considered a danger to their own child because they've said to the local GP, I'm actually abstaining from the vaccination schedule for on behalf of my child. We're not doing that. This is a deadly serious issue, and it can have serious consequences for parents when they stand up for their right to say, well, no, I don't want to immunise my child. I tell you this, Catherine, I don't have children. We'd love to have children. We hope to have children in the near future. We've already decided, and we're not melodramatic in any way, shape or form. If we're blessed to have a child, we're out of here, and we'll move to my partner's parent country, which is France. Because I know damn well that when it comes to it, and we say, well, no, we've decided our child is not going to be vaccinated, we're going to be in a world of problems with the local authorities
well,
in this country.
Well, it's hassle, isn't it? I mean, even if you don't end up, you know, having anything serious happen over it, you just know it's going to be hassle. I mean, my daughter is pregnant with her first child at the moment. She's in her early 30s, and she's been watching this Truth About Vaccines like a hawk. She's been and phoning me up every other day and saying, did you see that, Mum? Did you see, you know? And she has actually written, I think she told me, I think it's only in a little A5 book, but she told me yesterday, she said, I'm up to 36 pages, Mum. She's been writing notes all the way through. I mean, you can buy the series as well, and I will have a copy of it because I'll find it a useful reference thing to have. But, you know, she's been doing this. And you know why she's doing it? She's doing it because she knows she's going to have to argue her corner. And I think that's a dreadful way to enter into your first pregnancy.
Yeah. To worry
Knowing
about that,
that
to stress
you're
that.
Going to be, you know, someone's going to take pot shots at you. You're going to get that arrogant, condescending, who, you know, what do you think you're doing? You're putting other children at risk. All arguments, which, by the way, get demolished one by one in the Truth About Vaccines.
Well, you've demolished them yourself, Catherine. I mean, look, listen, you're very modest. I mean, science degrees, your background, you're in a position to demolish those pathetic herd immunity, and you're risking everybody else.
Well, I've learned things. I mean, I've learned things by watching the series. Although I've got quite a few books, I've got Truth About Vaccines, I've got The Vaccine-Damaged Child, Raising a Vaccine-Free Child. I've got Callous Disregard, which is Andrew Wakefield. Do you remember Andrew Wakefield?
Yeah, he's been on the programme a couple
of
times.
BMA,
yeah,
and his career ruined. Well, he's been vindicated now. You'll see that in The Truth About Vaccines as well. And all he actually said when you go back all that time was that he was a research gastroenterologist, and he had, what he said was, and he was actually doing this research with about 12 other people, there were 13 of them with their name on the paper, and one by one they got at them all until they kind of withdrew and wouldn't support the thing anymore, and it was left with him and one other person saying, no, we're standing by this research. And what he actually said was that in the research that he'd been asked to do, they had found residual measles vaccine in the guts of children with autism. That's what he said.
He's a great guy.
He didn't say there's a causal link between autism and the MMR.
He stays
although we're
fact.
Now beginning to find out that there might be, with all the research, more research that's been done in the interim. But he was right at the forefront of the start of that research back in about 1995, I think it was, from memory, or 97, thereabouts. And it turns out, you know, his observation, which was a factual observation, is now coming through in the research and showing. But in the meantime, we've had, how many years? 20-something years of more children
getting it,
being exposed. And the reason it happens that some children don't react and some, so let's just take the MMR. You've got not one, not two, but three vaccines being given all at once with what used to be a mercury preservative called thimerosal, or a mercury adjuvant called thimerosal, which they've now replaced with aluminium, though I understand they didn't do that replacement till they'd used up all the existing vaccine. And you have that being given to a child. I mean, children are born with virtually no immune system. They swallow their first helpful bacteria and other things as they come down the birth canal, which is why if they're born by cesarean, they don't get this start in life. If they're not breastfed, they're not getting the antibodies through the mother's milk, and that's a disadvantage to them as well. But if they're born in the normal manner and they're breastfed, that's what gets the start of their immunity. But it takes 2 years minimum for a child's immune system to develop, till they're at the point where they can literally stand on their own feet in terms of what's coming their way.
Catherine,
to be giving things to a child that has an immature immune system, not one, not two, but three vaccines, a heavy metal, and if that child's immune system is already struggling and it's got a little bit of, you know, whatever, but if for whatever reason that microbiome, the gut, hasn't got everything it should have, then
that can be catastrophic.
That's an awful impact on an immature immune system. And if the child's already struggling with something, then that is what pushes some of them over the edge, in my opinion.
Catherine, we're out of time. Okay. Thanks for coming on, first and foremost. Thanks for getting in touch.
Can I say one thing before I go to any parents that are struggling with special educational needs, whether it's autism, ADHD, dyspraxia, dyslexia, oppositional conduct? If you look up a thing called gut and psychology syndrome, so that's www.gaps.me, you'll come across Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride's site. Look at the frequently asked questions in particular and ask your questions there, and you will find there are some fabulous answers that will enlighten you into ways that you can help your child with neurological issues.
And those issues, I want to talk about those in a few weeks' time. No longer than that, I want to get you back on. Thanks for getting in touch, Catherine, and for having
You're
the courage
welcome.
To talk about these issues. I'm not paying lip service. I really mean that. Fabulous to talk to you. It was
okay,
an honour.
Richie.
Look after yourself. Talk again
okay.
real soon.
Will do. Bye-bye.
And bye for now. What an outstanding lady, Catherine Hannaford, on the line to us there. I have tweeted out the links for The Truth About Vaccines. Catherine mentioned Andy Wakefield. His film Vaxxed, the movie, is currently touring. I believe it's in the Republic of Ireland real soon. Pretty easy to find out more about that online. Catherine, educational psychologist with degrees in science, worked for Lancashire Council, worked in civil service in Northern Ireland, taught at primary and secondary school level, home educated as well. Truly, truly remarkable woman, really. Young woman, but retired recently. We'll get her back on the programme again. She's a lot more to say. We'll get her back on in a few weeks to talk about that, about nutrition, about the gut, and the link she gave there I'll tweet out again in a couple of seconds' time. It's 6.5 minutes to the top of the hour. Here's a very quick break. Back in a minute.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Right, that's pretty much it for the programme. It's 5 minutes to the top of the hour. Thanks for listening to it, by the way. A huge thanks to two fascinating guests tonight. Khalid Khan, UKIP member and vice chairman in Barnet, the UK Independence Party. Khalid might very well, in fact, be standing for UKIP in the future. I haven't changed my mind about the political paradigm. I haven't at all. It is completely controlled, lock, stock and barrel, by the cabal that we talk so much about on this programme. I have not and never will endorse any politician or any party. I had Norman Baker on from the Lib Dems last night. I wanted to take him on about the single market nonsense, so I took him on and I brought on a UKIP spokesman tonight to counter that. But I've not changed my opinion about elections. Never will. We'll never do that. We'll never do a 180 degree turn or flip-flop, to use that American colloquialism, on that particular thing. Terrific to have Khalid on, and Catherine Hannaford is an extraordinary woman, and I was delighted that she reached out to me. I'd love to take the production credit there and say I found her. I didn't know anything about her. She got in touch while I was on holiday to talk about the case of John Platt on the Isle of Wight, who was fined for taking his children out of school. The Supreme Court has upheld that decision. That is tyrannical, there's no doubt about that, and the implications of it are horrifying for parents in this country. We talked about so much more besides with Catherine as well. Great woman, and we'll definitely get her back on the programme in the very near future. To support this programme, please go to paypal.me/RichieAllen. Set up a recurring donation if you haven't before. RichieAllen.co.uk. On the homepage, there are bank account details there. Without your support, programmes like this, they don't have any future. It's as simple as that. So please do support the programme if you can. Thank you to Simon Stewart for all his work on YouTube. Simon, I'll be in touch tomorrow, mate, or Friday at the latest. I could have sent you a text, but I know you're listening, so I'll say it now. And to Aaron Calland as well. Stay with our broadcast partners, alternatecurrentradio.com, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and bookmark davidicke.com/headlines for all the news and all the analysis you need on a daily basis. That is it for the show. Thank you for listening. It wouldn't be a programme without your participation as well. My name is Richie Allen. That was Wednesday's Richie Allen Show, produced, edited and introduced by myself. Multitasking at its worst. Until tomorrow at 7 p.m. BST, look after yourselves and one another. Bye for now.